Chapter 25. The autopsies of Dorothy Kilgallen and Marilyn Monroe were each inexcusably and unprofessionally mishandled. Each bears a resemblance to the rank incompetence of the John F. Kennedy autopsy. While many similarities exist between the life and times and the deaths of these three 20th century icons, sadly, the revelation that each was denied justice flashes especially bright when considering the autopsies. In JFK's case, complete chaos followed his death, first in Dallas at Parkland Hospital, where his body was suddenly ruled off limits to the medical staff, and then in Washington, D.C., where the body was controversially and prematurely transferred. Looking back, it is almost as if J. Edgar Hoover, even moments after JFK was assassinated, had already begun scheming to distort history by proclaiming that it would be one person and only one person who was responsible for the president's demise. Of course, he didn't know at that point that a man named Lee Harvey Oswald would be arrested, but if one takes into account the diabolical mind of the FBI director, it is not a stretch to believe he was already plotting to take over any post-death investigation in order to ensure neither he nor the Bureau could be blamed for what had happened when the smoke cleared. Through the years, what exactly occurred, both at Parkland and in the nation's capital, has been debated ad infinitum. Every theory possible, both likely and absurd, has appeared to account for why, how, and by whom mistakes were made, muddying the waters as to what happened to the bullet or bullets that hit JFK's body, where the shot or shots were fired from, and so forth. Examining and evaluating all these theories would require a book longer than this one. Cutting through this web of confusion is best accomplished by turning to the wisdom of one man, the celebrated forensic scientist Dr. Cyril Wecht, both an M.D. and a J.D., and as such, a medical legal legend. Regarding Dr. Wecht's credentials, suffice it to say that the renowned attorney F. Lee Bailey said of Wecht before one famous case he handled, "He is the best medical expert witness in the country. You are going to get the truth. The bigger and tougher the case to solve, the more you need Cyril Wecht." Speaking of bigger and tougher, he has been connected to many of the most famous cases of both the 20th and 21st centuries, including those involving Robert Kennedy, Sharon Tate, Elvis Presley, JonBenet Ramsey, and singer Kurt Cobain. In 2020, Wecht was heavily quoted in the media regarding the 2020 George Floyd murder. Dr. Wecht explained that, despite statements to the contrary by the medical examiner in Minnesota, compression of the neck is the principal factor here leading to his death. In his groundbreaking book, Cause of Death, Wecht thoroughly analyzes the death of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. He does so by first referencing the findings of the Warren Commission to the effect that it concluded that three shots were fired. The first missile missed everyone and the car. The second bullet struck President Kennedy in the back, coursed through his upper back, and exited through the front of his neck at the level of the knot of his tie. The same bullet then hit Governor Connally in the back, went through the right side of his cheek, smashed through his right wrist, and finally lodged in his left thigh. A third bullet hit President Kennedy in the head. Regarding these conclusions and others presented in the commission's report, Wecht stated, "It is absolute nonsense. Libraries should move the report to the fiction section." He then added, "It is quite possibly the worst investigation of a homicide I have ever come across. Putting science aside and simply using reasonable common sense, much of the panel's rationalizations are downright silly." Addressing the autopsy conducted, Wecht called it botched, a terrible piece of medical-legal investigation. The people who did the autopsy were career military officers who had no forensic pathology experience. It was incredibly orchestrated incompetence. To that point, he believed, "The autopsy should have been done right there in Dallas by the city's medical examiner, Dr. Earl Rose, since the murder was a state crime, not a federal crime." Wecht added, When Dr. Rose announced he was planning on doing the autopsy, Secret Service agents, their hands gripping automatic weapons, announced with much authority and many vulgarities that they would not permit that to happen, and used physical force to remove John Kennedy's body from the hospital. Chronicling what happened next, Dr. Wecht revealed that the body was flown to Bethesda Naval Medical Center, where at 8 p.m. the autopsy began. Despite the presence of very competent and well-known forensic pathologists in the D.C. area, these experts were never consulted, and instead inexperienced military pathologists took over. The first mistake made by those who conducted the autopsy, Wecht noted, arose from them not having spoken with the doctors at Parkland. As he stated in his book, "It is a cardinal rule when performing an autopsy on a body that has been shot or stabbed to talk to the surgeon who treated the victim initially before examining the body. Such a violation of standard procedures," Wecht wrote, "resulted in the biggest mistake of all. The autopsy pathologists were unaware that when Kennedy was wheeled into the hospital, the doctors noticed that in the front of the neck a bullet hole had perforated the windpipe." Wecht pointed to several other instances of incompetence, including, as illogical as it seems, that the pathologists never dissected President Kennedy's brain to examine the gunshot wounds. Adding to the incompetence, Wecht wrote, "The Navy commander, James J. Humes, who did much of the physical examination of the president's body, burned his notes in his fireplace on November 24, 1963. In addition to the botched autopsy, Wecht, who spent more than 8 hours a day, 2 days running, examining all of the physical evidence, including the clothes worn by both President Kennedy and Governor Connally, pointed out that the basic investigation by police was similarly shabby, and that the crime scene investigation itself was another example of professional incompetence, debunking any sense of the claim that all of the shots fired came from the book depository building. Wecht called the Oswald alone theory ridiculous. Shifting to the Dorothy Kilgallen autopsy, one important question must be raised. Why was an autopsy called for in the first place? Apparently, Detective John Doyle took one look at the death scene, which included the empty Seconal bottle, and decided Kilgallen had accidentally overdosed. End of story. It is difficult to believe he did not convey this reasoning to Dr. Luke in Dorothy's townhouse, but, regardless, the autopsy was ordered. Also, since Dr. Milton Helpern was so skilled at his position in 1965, it must be asked why he assigned such an important case to Dr. James Luke, a junior medical examiner. Given that Helpern loved the limelight, the logical move would have been for him to handle the case on his own so as to grab headlines. His not doing so raises questions of whether there could have been a definite plan to exclude himself from becoming involved in Kilgallen's case. Thus, like in Maryland's situation where Dr. Thomas Noguchi, a deputy medical examiner, was chosen, one must unfortunately speculate as to what would have happened if the famous Dr. Helpern had conducted Kilgallen's autopsy. Common sense dictates that he would have focused much more on the amount of barbiturates in Kilgallen's bloodstream and realized that the presence of Tuenol, along with Seconal, meant careful words of caution needed to be given to the media regarding cause of death. But instead, he apparently approved Dr. Luke not only telling the media Kilgallen's death appeared to be accidental, but adding the confusing, misleading words, "circumstances undetermined," to the official report. These words waffled with extraordinary undertones, which in turn tarnished Kilgallen's reputation for decades to come. Since the names listed on Kilgallen's autopsy report were Dr. Luke, Dr. Michael Baden, and Dr. William Q. Stirner, each a junior medical examiner, only Dr. Helpern knew why he chose Dr. Luke, and Helpern died in 1977. Thus, Dr. Luke was charged with conducting the autopsy and the analysis despite his lack of experience, which compares with Dr. Noguchi in Marilyn's case. Dr. Michael Baden was later to become chief medical examiner for the city of New York from 1978 to 1979, as well as chairman of the House Select Committee on Assassinations Forensic Pathology Panel that investigated the assassination of JFK. Baden was a controversial figure who was removed from his position by New York City Mayor Ed Koch after he had received complaints about his work. Baden then took the same position a few miles away in Suffolk County, but was dismissed for allegedly making inappropriate comments about how to commit the perfect murder. Despite these public ridicules, Baden became famous for his work on the O.J. Simpson case, the Phil Spector murder trial, the New England Patriots' Aaron Hernandez suicide, and, most recently, the Jeffrey Epstein and George Floyd cases. While being interviewed by this author on February 8, 2020, regarding Kilgallen's case, he recalled vividly being present during the autopsy and offered various accounts about what happened back in 1965. Confronted with the Kilgallen autopsy report indicating the presence of two barbiturates, secanol and tuinol, not one, found in Kilgallen's system, and the fact that the media and thus the general public were only made aware of the secanol overdose, Dr. Baden began backing away from any responsibility for mistakes made. This error, he said, only dealt with cause of death. His response fails to consider the importance of the error, which facilitated a brainwashing of the media and the general public by insinuating that Kilgallen accidentally overdosed. When reminded that a third barbiturate, Nembutal, was later discovered in Dorothy's system and that the presence of this drug strongly suggested that her death could not have been accidental, Baden appeared to believe that the discovery of an additional drug, which Dr. Luke and he missed, was no big deal. Dr. Baden reacted with similar apathy when told traces of the Nembutal were discovered on the rim of a glass from Kilgallen's bedroom table, and that this meant someone emptied the capsules before ingesting the drugs, which makes little sense in a case of accidental death. Instead of considering why this happened and agreeing that the discovery of Nembutal on the glass changed everything about how Kilgallen died, that these clues assuredly pointed to foul play, Baden responded, "It would have made little difference to the accidental death verdict Dr. Luke reached, a complete disregard for the importance of this evidence." As he spoke, this author surprised him with the news that his name appears on the botched autopsy report. But Baden's attitude continued to be defiant as he attempted to disqualify himself from any blame for mistakes made. The fresh analysis of Kilgallen's bodily fluids revealing both the third barbiturate in her system and the Nembutal remnants on the drinking glass took place in 1968. That was 3 years after Kilgallen died and the year Robert Kennedy was killed, triggering an apparent cover-up of the new evidence conflicting with the official ME report. It began when medical examiner Dr. Charles Umberger, under the tutelage of Dr. Helpern, saved Kilgallen's bodily fluids by using forensic cryonics, believing technological advances in the future might provide more clarity as to how Kilgallen died. Dr. Umberger was the NYC Medical Examiner's Office Director of Toxicology in the Department of Pathology at the time of Kilgallen's death. Retired Dutchess County Sheriff's Detective Dennis O'Keefe knew Dr. Umberger, known to the detectives as Charlie Joe, and told this author, "really knew his stuff. He was very likable, comedic, wore expensive suits that were always wrinkled." Regarding Dr. Umberger's habits, O'Keefe said the doctor was known for saving beakers of bodily fluid specimens in hopes that technology advancements would aid future homicide investigations, as happened in Kilgallen's case. "I remember one time Umberger stored blood samples in our office refrigerator, and one of the guys in the sheriff's office asked him how long a blood sample could be valid, and Umberger said at least 2 years and maybe more." O'Keefe also stated, based on his experience with cases at the Manhattan branch of the ME's office, "the whole crew was a puzzle," with the comment meant to indicate chaos in the office. Why Dr. Umberger singled out Kilgallen's case is curious. Speculation may be that he wasn't satisfied with Dr. Luke's conclusions and decided to preserve evidence for later analysis. Dr. Umberger retired in 1972 and died 5 years later. According to his colleague, toxicologist John Broich, Umberger had hinted that Kilgallen had been murdered. Broich also said Umberger admitted he had evidence proving Kilgallen's death was indeed murder and that he kept this secret from the ME Department of Pathology. Relying on the excuse that he was wary of the toxic politics weaving through the medical examiner's office at the time, Dr. Umberger was careful not to divulge his findings. However, he did share his raw data with Broich. According to Broich, and confirmed by his wife Eileen and son Chris, Dr. Umberger asked Broich to examine a basic beaker with an extract from Dorothy's brain and another beaker labeled drink. Also provided to the chemist were two glasses which had contained alcoholic beverages that had been discovered at Kilgallen's bedside table. Dr. Umberger told the chemist his examination had revealed one was a drink glass from which the alcohol had evaporated, which was hers, Kilgallen's, without indicating how he knew this to be true. Broich said, through further testing, he and Umberger discovered evidence that three barbiturates, secanol, nembutol, and tuinol, were present in Kilgallen's bloodstream. In addition, Broich reported that a rim specimen taken from one of two glasses attributed to Kilgallen contained traces of nembutol. When Broich told Umberger of his discovery, Broich said Umberger grinned and told him, "Keep it under your hat. This was big." Regarding the traces of nembutol discovered on the drinking glass, Dr. Donald Hoffman, a revered senior chemist in toxicology at the Manhattan ME's office beginning in 1969, disagrees with Dr. Baden that the discovery of the three barbiturates wasn't important. Hoffman told this author, "This opens the door as to how she came to ingest it. The presence of the pentobarbital itself on the glass clearly implies that she reasonably could have ingested a liquid containing this drug. If so, then how did she come to have it in the first place, since she was only prescribed secanol?" Obviously, the drinking glass traces were highly significant to Dr. Hoffman. He concluded, "I can't get around this physical evidence pointing to a homicide, not accidental death or suicide." Regarding the timing of Kilgallen's death, Dr. Baden had admitted, "Yes, it was very convenient for a lot of people." He agreed that she could likely have been planning to expose those involved in JFK's assassination in the book she was writing for Random House. Most important, when pressed for more definitive answers to what happened at the ME's office, Dr. Baden mentioned that Dr. James Luke's inclusion of the words "circumstances undetermined" to qualify the conclusion that Kilgallen died of an overdose of barbiturates combined with alcohol meant that the ME's office wasn't sure how she really died, that there was not a clear cause of death. Probed further, Dr. Baden admitted Kilgallen's death could have been due to 1. Natural causes, 2. Suicide, 3. Accident, or 4. Homicide. Nevertheless, he seemed unconcerned that even though these four possibilities existed, this information was never communicated to the media and the general public. This failure left in place the strong and very misleading impression that Kilgallen died of an accidental overdose. Dr. Baden also noted that the percentage of barbiturate found in Dorothy's brain and liver indicated that the body reposited the equivalent of 15 to 20 secanol capsules. He further stated that he and Dr. Luke expected the NYPD detectives would follow through, as would be normal in what Baden called a high-profile VIP international case, his first high-profile case, with what he dubbed a full investigation. He then agreed that the death scene was quite suspicious and that he recalled serious discussions with Dr. Luke and NYC Chief Medical Examiner Dr. Milton Helpern about Kilgallen's case. Regardless of these serious discussions, Baden apparently never objected to Dr. Luke's insidious media disclosures, which included not only circumstances undetermined, but the following statement, which compounded the uncertainty surrounding Kilgallen's cause of death. "We'd rather leave that up in the air. We don't want to give that out, well, just because." Also, Kilgallen had taken on moderate amounts of alcohol and the drug before her death, but I won't give any figures. Dr. Luke, a junior medical examiner in his first big case, thus jumped to conclusions without warrant, failed the victim, and failed to give her the respect she deserved by being an enabler to the accidental death verdict that has stood to this day. And regardless of his excuses, Baden was an enabler as well. Confronted with the evidence that the certificate of death in Kilgallen's case was signed by Dr. Dominic DeMeo, M.D., for James Luke, Dr. Baden had no explanation as to why Dr. DeMeo, assigned at the time to the Brooklyn branch of the medical examiner's office, handled that task instead of Dr. Luke or him. Baden also added to the confusion when stating that it had been the Brooklyn branch of the ME's office answering the call from Kilgallen's townhouse, only to have the request for a coroner switched to the Manhattan branch. As will become clear, it appears that only the Manhattan branch was destined to handle her autopsy, a change of opinion by this author from what was originally believed to have happened. For certain, mistakes, as noted, abounded with the preparation of Kilgallen's amended certificate of death. Dorothy's last name wasn't Colmer. Kilgallen is misspelled as K-I-L-L-G-A-L-L-E-N, the same mistake made in her autopsy report, and her date of birth is wrong, as previously mentioned. Also, she did not die at 12 noon. Her body was discovered before or at around 9 a.m., and she had been dead for hours. When asked about these discrepancies, Baden claimed he never knew they existed, even though common sense dictates he would have read the certificate of death, and if he didn't, he should have done so. Continuing to be on the defensive during his interview with this author, Baden, who was provided a copy of Denial of Justice, which included the three barbiturate conclusion, avoided speaking about that issue. He also appeared to have limited interest in revisiting Kilgallen's death, stating, "It wasn't my case," while suggesting that a contact be made with Dr. Luke, whose whereabouts at the time of this writing are unknown. Analyzing Baden's comments 55 years after Kilgallen's confusing autopsy, especially his reluctance to admit any responsibility, becomes clearer when additional facts, disturbing in nature, are considered based on the eyewitness accounts from those who were at the Manhattan Medical Examiner's office in the mid to late 1960s and early 1970s. Detective John Doyle, the first NYPD officer to arrive at the Kilgallen townhouse after she died, believed there were problems galore with the information the ME's office forwarded to him about her death. In an interview with this author's research assistant, Doyle said, "All I got from the ME's office was a slip of paper saying, 'death due to visceral congestion.' No more detailed report than that. If there was any cover-up on this whatsoever, it would have been down at the ME's office." He added, "They never went into detail. Had it been explained to me that there was an overly amount of barbiturates in the system, then I probably would have dug a little deeper. There was no indication at all that there was anything out of the ordinary." There is no mention in any ME document discovered dealing with the slip of paper Doyle says he received from the Manhattan office. And there is nothing about the cause of death allegedly being visceral congestion, a classic symptom of drug overdoses culminating in a bloody froth emanating from the victim's nose and mouth. Doyle's admission is shocking when he swears, "If there was any cover-up on this whatsoever, it would have been down at the ME's office." More than 10 years after Kilgallen died, the New York Medical Examiner's Office received a request from G. Robert Blakey, chief counsel and director of the House Select Committee on Assassinations. As noted, it was charged with considering new evidence about the JFK and Martin Luther King assassinations collected since the 1960s. After some unknown delay, Blakey's request, which this author obtained from the National Archives, landed on the desk of Dominic J. DeMeo, M.D. Chief Medical Examiner. Dr. DeMeo, who signed Kilgallen's death certificate, wrote back to Mr. Blakey on April 13, 1978, "Enclosed you will find the complete file on Ms. Kilgallen, who died on November 8, 1965. A 2016 request from this author regarding the HSCA interest in Kilgallen was forwarded to Blakey. His response was most interesting. "Our look into Kilgallen's death was not substantial. In any event, we thought it was fishy. But we were not able to solve it and do JKK, JFK, and Martin Luther King assassination investigation at the same time." In mid-1992, reporter Bill Curtis interviewed Blakey. The journalist quoted Blakey as stating, "I wish in my heart of hearts that the Chief Justice had paid attention to what Jack Ruby had said and had taken him to Washington, D.C., taken him out of the custody of the Dallas PD or the Sheriff's Department, and got him into the custody of the United States Marshals, who would have protected him. We might have learned the truth about Ruby's connection to the assassination." Kilgallen, based on her investigation, would surely have agreed with Blakey's opinion, since she knew for certain Jack Ruby was the key to solving the greatest murder mystery in history. Concerning John Broich, his wife Eileen told this author, "John was forced to leave the ME's office. He admitted mafia presence in the office. They were intimidating. He called one time from the city and was terrified. He was strong-willed. He wouldn't be bought. There was pressure to fudge results. I said, 'Why don't you go to the police?' John said, 'They can't help me.'" In the coming years, Eileen said, the Broich family moved several times, even to Pennsylvania, because John believed we were being followed. She added, "The ME office was investigated. A lot of shenanigans were going on with corpses, necrophilia, and such." Chris Broich, John's son, said his father had been blacklisted, causing problems with alternative employment in his field. In 2020, Eileen Broich, at the request of this author, confirmed to son Chris that Dr. Umberger visited our house in 1968. It was in Rocky Point, New York, corner of Prince and Harding Road, to discuss the Kilgallen toxicology report John did. She added, "It was about what not to say or talk publicly about it." Asked to comment on the qualifications of John Broich and Charles Umberger, Dr. Hoffman told this author that Umberger was one of the founding fathers of forensic toxicology. Regarding Broich, Dr. Hoffman said he was an excellent toxicologist, sharp, had good intuitive knowledge. While praising Umberger and Broich, Dr. Hoffman, who spent 17 years in the ME's office and is still teaching at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City, called the techniques used in the medical examiner's office crude during the early 1960s. Specifically addressing these techniques, Dr. Hoffman said they lacked the analytic sensitivity, specificity, and confirmatory nature available during later years. This damaged the reliability of testing, causing any conclusions to be questionable. Stephen Goldner, the supervising forensic toxicologist at the ME's office from 1970 to 1974, was a close personal friend of the Broich family. He said, "My understanding was that the same paranoia being rampant, existing then, 1970s, had existed in the mid to late 1960s because of the mafia influence. Goldner intended to write a book about how the mafia controlled the NYC ME's office, while stating John Broich was one of the heroes because he wouldn't alter toxicology reports like others did." When asked why he never wrote the book, Goldner said, "I wanted to stay alive." Goldner, who recalled Dr. Milton Helpern and Dr. Michael Baden, he was an arrogant asshole, but a very hard-working, fastidious pathologist, witnessed the Mafia control at the Manhattan branch of the Medical Examiner's Office. The Mafia had taken control of a large part of the analyses being done. Broich and I and other toxicologists were expected to cooperate and sign off on reports even if they doubted the accuracy. And it wasn't as if mobster Joe Bonanno or a guy from Brooklyn walked in and said, "I own you guys," but we knew what was going on. But on a day-to-day basis, it was pretty clear what was happening. For instance, one-half to two-thirds of the people employed in the laboratories were Sicilian, related to each other, pretty much from the same couple of towns in Sicily. And anyone who was supposed to have a college degree, somehow those records were lost, supposedly since they got their degrees in Sicily. Their credentials were fuzzy to the point that one toxicologist who allegedly had a Ph.D. couldn't identify a simple structure for benzene, leading me to believe the man was not even a chemist. Further, Goldner said he witnessed the fudging of toxicological reports. He added that certain cases, like Kilgallen's in the 1960s, piqued interest and were never solved. Goldner added, "There was a pattern to these cases. You could infer things that didn't add up." When Goldner and John Broich worked to stop the Mafia influence, stop this inappropriate influence, it was costly for John, costly for me, Goldner said. He added, "Investigations went nowhere, and yes, I was scared because of the pressure. They made it clear that it isn't going to work well for you if you go to the cops." The final straw, Goldner said, leading to he and Broich being forced to leave the office, was disturbing. He said, "There was an analysis work done by a person not competent to do so, not trained, and it ended up in an official toxicology report. John and I were told to sign off, and we refused to do so. We knew we were being set up, but had to sign or else. It was like, listen, the Sicilians are running the place, and you better sign. When we didn't, we were escorted out of the office, and that was it." Based on the disturbing accounts from John Broich and Stephen Goldner exposing a mafia-controlled Manhattan medical examiner's office and its contaminating atmosphere where lies prevailed under the tutelage of the legendary Dr. Milton Helpern, it's no wonder Dr. Umberger told Broich not to divulge the results of the tests confirming three barbiturates in Kilgallen's blood system, but instead to keep it under your hat. Doing so caused a cover-up, since if those results had been released, the cause of death could have been clarified. But this never happened. During his February 25, 2020 phone interview with this author, Dr. Michael Baden disputed Broich and Goldner's descriptions of the chaos surrounding the Manhattan branch of the New York Medical Examiner's Office. He first said what the two toxicologists reported doesn't make it untrue. Then, eventually, he stated that what they said was untrue. Confronted with the blatant mistakes in Kilgallen's certificate of death, Baden asked that a copy be forwarded to him by email. After his receipt of the document, he failed to respond to the accusations that mismanagement of her death began with that certificate and became worse as time passed, ending with Dr. Luke's bogus announcement that she had died accidentally, circumstances undetermined. Despite the irregularities at the Kilgallen death scene, similar to those when Marilyn Monroe died, there had been no investigation in either case. Based on discovering an empty bottle of secanol on a bedside table, the authorities had decided Kilgallen had died accidentally. Rush to judgment was the call of the day, but fresh evidence discovered following the publication of Denial of Justice in 2018 points to her being murdered. Considering the death scene provides some clarity. To be certain, Charles Simpson and Mark Sinclair, who, it may be recalled, said she never slept in the bedroom where he had discovered her body, were, as noted, never interviewed by police. Each was certainly available and well known to be in her employ, but for whatever reason, neither was contacted. In his report, Detective John Doyle stated that when he entered the residence, motion picture star Joan Crawford and Kilgallen's father, Jim, were present, along with Kilgallen's husband, Richard. Regarding his state of mind, Doyle said Richard was completely inebriated. I don't even think he knew his own name. Through slurred speech, Richard, sitting in the black room, told Doyle, "My wife fell asleep while she was reading in a half-sitting position." Doyle was curious about this statement while recalling that the reading light next to the bed where the body was discovered was on. Detective Doyle did not address who called the medical examiner's office. Finally, he said, Dr. James Luke arrived after Doyle had written in his report that there was an empty bottle of Seconal, previously containing 50 100-milligram capsules, on the nightstand near Kilgallen's bed. Reading the name of Hunter Pharmacy on the bottle, Doyle and his partner went to the Madison Avenue location. He must have told Dr. Luke of this visit since the medical examiner included the information in the official documents. Doyle later stated that Kilgallen's Seconal prescription history for the previous 3+ years indicated that she had averaged taking 2 pills per day. This amount was certainly not an abuse of the drug, nothing out of the average for those who battled insomnia. Later, Detective Doyle was angered when he was told that the empty vial, which should have been marked as evidence, was not delivered to the police station or the medical examiner's office. Like Kilgallen's JFK assassination investigation file and Marilyn's notebooks, the vial disappeared. Former Detective Dennis O'Keefe knew Dr. Charles Umberger and vouched for his capacity to keep bodily fluid specimens for later testing. Further, he knew Detective John Doyle as Jack Popeye Doyle, who, along with Detective Mike Ward, had arrived at Kilgallen's townhouse on the day she died. O'Keefe told this author that Jack Doyle called me before I retired and said a retired professor had tried to get a hold of him. O'Keefe then added that Doyle recalled, "I was a young detective and responded to the death of Dorothy Kilgallen. I filled out the death report, a DD-5 form. It also contained all of my interview notes." Apparently, the DD-5, Detective Division 5, revealed for the first time in denial of justice, suggested the cause of death as visceral congestion. It is a classic symptom of drug overdoses, culminating in a bloody froth emanating from the victim's nose and mouth. When her death was reported to the police, one may question why a young detective was called to the location of a known celebrity like Kilgallen's home, a case that had media attention all over it. Patrick Piccarelli, a former NYPD lieutenant and co-author of Hollywood Godfather with Gianni Russo, told this author in early 2020, "The NYPD Detective Bureau assigns cases from a list which is called the catch list. This is an actual hierarchical list in no particular order. Whoever is next to catch a case comes off the top of the list with no exceptions. In the Kilgallen case, it was the young detective's turn. If a case is deemed a homicide, the Precinct Detective Unit, PDU, passes the case to the Bureau Homicide Unit. This was not the case with her case because the death wasn't deemed suspicious and resulted in an accidental death disposition. Thus, the disposition of Kilgallen's case, labeled as accidental instead of circumstances undetermined and thus suspicious, denied Kilgallen her right to have the case assigned to and reviewed by the Borough Homicide Unit. Instead of that review and potential investigation, there was no investigation. This happened despite, it may be recalled, Dr. Luke noting in his own handwriting on the autopsy report that there was no past history of alcoholism or other medicinal habits on Kilgallen's part. That should have been a clue to conducting, at the very least, some sort of an investigation, but this never occurred. Unfortunately for those interested in the truth, that DD-5 document, which provided an alternative cause of death, has been missing since Kilgallen died. Attempts by this author, as will be explained, to retrieve it and other documents through Freedom of Information requests relating to her death from governmental agencies have thus far been ignored. Curiously, within a month of Kilgallen's death, Detective Doyle, the father of six children and described as a trim, blue-eyed man at the time who favored polyester suits and sounded to this author's researcher like a tough guy from Brooklyn, Goodfellas style, resigned without a pension from the police force. He left New York City and opened Doyle's Terrace Restaurant near LaGrangeville, New York, near apple-picking country. No doubt exists Kilgallen was scared of harm shortly before she died. Charles Simpson said during his videotaped interview, "Kilgallen never quit investigating, never quit. She dug up something about the assassination of President Kennedy that somebody didn't want her to know because she even told us of her own volition, 'I used to share things with you guys, but after I have found out now what I know, if the wrong people knew what I know, it would cost me my life,' and she was dead about 9 months later." Simpson added, "She told me about a couple of weeks before she died that she was going to get a gun because her life was being threatened and she was scared for her life and for her family." This is the same Charles Simpson who had a special affection for the gifted journalist. Mark Sinclair had introduced them. Over time, Simpson became Kilgallen's trusted friend. He was most impressed with her humble manner, and during the recorded interview in the late 1990s, Simpson said Kilgallen was even gracious to the girls at the desk, all the small people, a reference to Lily Dachet's popular Midtown Manhattan salon. He added, "I've never known this woman, Dorothy, to be mean in any way." He also said, "Dorothy had a rosary, a pearl rosary, and she would take it out on the second floor of her townhouse, a five-story Georgian mansion, and what she did was go out, and there was a little hedge on there, and she would lay the rosary out there when Mark or I flew anywhere and leave it there until we returned, and she told us she did this." Regarding a lengthy conversation 2 days before Kilgallen died, Mark Sinclair said, "I was at her house almost every night that week, the week before she died. She was worried about her life. She said, 'I have to get a gun because someone's going to kill me.' And I jokingly said, 'Oh, Dorothy, who would want to kill you?' So that started a conversation. And then time elapsed over us talking about this, and she said, 'Well, I had to draw a new will.'" Author's note, a will was never found or filed with the court after she died. Another aspect of her life scared Kilgallen. Asked if she was worried about youngest son Kerry during the month before she died, Sinclair replied, "Yes, after a picture of Kerry appeared in the paper, a large picture of him alone in the middle of Central Park, she was very worried that Kerry would be kidnapped. Obviously, she didn't allow that kind of picture to be taken and be put in the paper of him all alone playing baseball, but he wasn't even playing baseball. He was just running across a field, and that means that someone was following him. Kerry's name did not appear with the photo. It was frightening to her because he was alone." Frightening for sure, and one may only imagine the anger Kilgallen felt since her private world, the one she protected at all costs, especially regarding the lives of her children, had been infiltrated. Without question, the emotional strain would have taken its toll, and she very well could have cried herself to sleep the night after the photo appeared. In all likelihood, Dorothy would have already called the powers that be at the newspaper and blasted them for printing the photograph. Efforts to locate the photo have not proven fruitful. Meanwhile, Brenda Desjardins added to what was happening at the time, telling this author, "My dad knew what Dorothy was doing, that she was investigating the JFK assassination and Jack Ruby. When a courier couldn't take her columns to the newspaper, he did, and I rode along with him. He also warned her to leave Ruby alone, that she was dealing with dangerous people who could cause her harm. Mark Sinclair warned her, too. He and my dad talked about this. My father started to worry when Dorothy exposed the whole Ruby deal with the Warren Commission. He warned her, Don't open up a can of worms. You are putting yourself in jeopardy. Without question, the drum roll toward Kilgallen's death was on a fast track. Despite signs pointing there, she had long felt invincible, that none of her enemies could touch her. She was wrong.